You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a conservative think tank gave Wisconsin an F for its statewide standards on teaching civics and U.S. history. We'll take a look at the importance of civics education and what policymakers here are doing about it. Now, an advisory for listeners, our next conversation deals with violence against women. The disappearance and homicide of Gabby Petito has seen a massive wave of attention on social media and in the press. The story has dominated headlines and TV news coverage. According to one count from the Washington Post, her name was mentioned more than 800 times on cable news over a seven-day stretch this month. But media watchers have also said the story is shining a light on the disparity between media attention paid to missing white women and people, especially women of color. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you noticed this disparity yourself? What do you think is behind it? I think the media needs to do a better job covering crimes against communities of color. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Molly Jongfast is a contributing editor to The Daily Beast. Her recent piece is titled What Gabby Petito's Case Says About Cops and Us. Molly, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Now, this is, of course, a tragic story, and I don't think anybody's saying it shouldn't be covered, but you write, and others have said, it shows a disparity in media attention when there's a white woman going missing versus people of color. Can you talk about your thoughts on that a little?
Well, it's an interesting, we do find ourselves in a situation where it's almost misogynistic that the women who get the most coverage are very attractive white women. And I think that it's a sort of strange phenomenon. And if you look through history, Gwen Ifill was the person who talked about it, who started this idea of missing white woman syndrome, that they're, the press sort of gets attached to a story of a very attractive white woman. And you can think of their names throughout decades. Cassandra Levy, there are, different women throughout the ages who have become these sort of figures. And if you think about it, it really is approximately three women every day are murdered by intimate partners. So the idea that it's just one that becomes the story is really kind of unfair.
Coming up, we'll talk to a co-chair of a task force on missing and murdered Indigenous women in Wisconsin. You looked at how many Indigenous people went missing in the area where Gabby Petito had gone missing. Can you talk about what you found?
Yeah, there was other reporting that said that it was about 700 Indigenous women over about 8 years had gone missing in that same area where Gabby Petito had gone missing. I actually read other statistics that say the number is much higher, and the reporting on that is not totally clear, which is why the Department of the Interior is starting this Indigenous Woman Tracking Project to really find out what the real numbers are.
What do you think drives this outsized attention, this disparity in attention from the media?
If you look at Gabby Petito, she's very beautiful. She has sort of a lot of photos of her on social media. People felt a little bit invested because they sort of knew her from social media. But she also is the sort of the stereotypical beautiful blonde haired woman. So I think that there's a sort of kind of natural draw to that. And ultimately it's upsetting. And also there are hundreds of other cases every day that are not getting even a fraction of the kind of attention. So it ends up being very dispiriting.
I've seen with sensationalized stories in the past where sometimes a news publisher or editor might say, well, this is what our audience wants, so we're giving it to them. I can't cite anything that's happened with this particular instance. But what do you think of that idea that the media is maybe just feeding what the public wants here?
I think that isn't actually true. Like if you look at something like Serial, I think that when it comes to cases like this, these kind of murder cases, they tend to be what's covered gets people interested. So it's not quite the same, I think, as, covering, for example, like Britney Spears is very famous. So there's a lot of interest in that story. Whereas this is, you know, these kind of tragic stories are interesting if you cover them. I mean, I think they're also tragic and disturbing. And, you know, there's a larger issue of like how we cover domestic violence, which I think is very, very important. And, you know, if you see one thing in this story that really, besides the fact that they're not covering all of these other women, these indigenous women, these, you know, women from different cultures, African-American women, Hispanic women who are not going missing. The other thing I think is really should be taken away from this case is that the police really, I mean, we don't know exactly what happened, but it strikes me that the domestic violence stop was a real mistake on the police's part.
We're talking to Molly Jong-Fast, contributing editor of the Daily Beast, looking at the coverage of missing and murdered women and the Gabby Petito case. Got a lot of media attention as compared to when women of color are missing. Many of them don't get much or even any coverage at all in the media. Molly, I was going to ask you about that and the what can we learn about how we treat domestic violence, domestic abuse, both for police and for us in the media?
So all we really know is what we've seen from that traffic stop camera. But what the sort of notes that I've read say that the police thought that she was abusing him, which statistically is very unusual. So for a police to get there strikes me as really problematic. Right? I mean, I think the assumption should always be that the more likely scenario is that the man is abusing the woman, because statistically it's much, 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 much more likely. So, and then they ask him if he's okay. And then they let her, he goes to a hotel and she sleeps, or she goes to a hotel. One of them goes to a hotel and one of them goes to sleep in the car. But it, you know, it is absolutely, I mean, if this was the, you know, they had an opportunity to change the course of things, and that didn't happen. So I think that's a good question is, are police really trained to look at domestic violence situations, and can they de-escalate as opposed to just letting people go off?
Getting back to the media coverage side of the story, Molly, there was a lot of coverage of this particular tragic instance. But there's been a lot of media reporting, including your article that made us give you a call, critiquing the media and this disproportionate coverage. Do you think that things might change after this?
I mean, again, this is one of these situations where it's like, if you cover something, it will be covered, right? So the question is, how do we cover missing Indigenous women? How do we cover domestic violence as a larger issue? How do we cover missing women? And I think we have to look at ourselves all the time. I mean, I think the solution to all of this is always to have a newsroom that looks more like America. You know, stories are covered when you have real representation. So that would be my first thought. But I do think like we all have to always look at ourselves and look at our implicit biases and look at the stories that we think are interesting and ask ourselves, are we really being fair to what's going on in America?
Molly, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Molly Jong-Fast, contributing editor for The Daily Beast. She was with us today to talk about her recent piece, What Gabby Petito's Case Says About Cops and Us. Up next, we'll talk to one of the leaders of a state task force looking into the issue of missing and murdered Indigenous women here in Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think there is enough awareness on this issue of missing and murdered Indigenous women? Do you want to see more support to the state's tribal nations to deal with this problem? Is this something that's affected your own life? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk now about a disparity in attention paid to missing white women versus women of color. As part of that conversation, we'll take a closer look now at the issue of missing and murdered Indigenous women. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If this is an issue that's affected your own life, that's 800-642-1234. Justine Rufus is co-chair of the Wisconsin Department of Justice Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women Task Force. She's rural coordinator for the Wisconsin Coalition Against Sexual Assault and a member of the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa. Justin, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. I appreciate you taking the time to speak with me today.
Can you tell us about how big a problem this is in Wisconsin?
You know, one of the tasks that the task force is really looking at is trying to figure out what that number is. We know that there wouldn't be a need for a task force if this wasn't a real problem in Wisconsin, and we know that it's happening in our backyards. And I often kind of say an example of my community. So I come from a small reservation of less than a population of 500, and in my lifetime, I can name four women that have gone missing from my community. And I think that if other folks live in small towns, that's a very large number. And when we go from reservation to reservation, that's the same kind of things that we're seeing in each of our communities. And so it's very scary that this type of violence is happening against Indigenous communities right in our backyard here in Wisconsin.
Do we have even good enough data to give us a clear understanding of how big a problem this is?
No, that's a huge problem. I think that we're not only facing here in Wisconsin, but nationwide, is the data collection is just not there. We also understand that Indigenous communities don't have direct access to systems. For example, NCIC database, which every other officer might use in order to report a missing person. And so this lack of infrastructure coupled with the lack of the fact that most Indigenous folks live off reservation. It's estimated that 70-80% of our population is not actually living on the reservation. It's really hard to keep track of the data. And then misclassification is one of the highest things that we're seeing when it does come to the data on our folks not even being identified as Indigenous or misclassified in the way that the cause of death.
As we heard from our last guest, there is a disproportionate amount of coverage in many cases when a white woman goes missing versus people from other communities. Do you see this yourself, a lack of media attention or awareness of this problem?
And yes, absolutely. This has been a historical issue. I often do a training for new advocates throughout the state when they're getting trained as new advocates. And I used to ask them to raise their hand if they've ever seen on television an Indigenous person that's gone missing. And the few times that I've had the hand raised, it was in another state or it was a child. But it was rare that anyone raised their hand when it came to women and didn't even understand how tremendous of a critical issue this is in Indian country, and how many of us are disappearing without any media attention is quite scary.
Why do you think that is? Why do you think that an issue that's clearly not under the radar for you and the communities you're working with, why do you think it's gone so under the radar in general in the media?
You know, I just honestly need to say, I don't know what the answer to that is. I wish that oftentimes I think when it comes to tribes, you know, there's that tribal sovereignty that really separates us from other communities. But we all need to recognize that this is happening here in Wisconsin, and this can no longer be just an Indigenous issue. This has to be a humanitarian issue. We have to care more about what is happening amongst us.
Talking to Justine Rufus, co-chair of the Wisconsin Department of Justice Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women Task Force, talking about the scope of the problem of missing and murdered Indigenous women in the state, what is getting in the way of even having good data and information, and possible solutions. And let's start looking at changes you want to see. And first of all, it sounds like there's a communication and coordination issue between different police agencies, the state, tribal, and local. What kind of things are you hoping to see change?
Well, we're recognizing that so nationwide, and this isn't just an issue in Wisconsin, that we're starting to understand the systems better as we're doing this work. And there is no one set protocol for when folks go missing. And so what Indigenous communities rely heavily on, especially in public law 280 states, which we're in, it is a trust responsibility for the state to help us when someone goes missing. And so it makes it complicated when there's not only one police force involved, but for our cases, there's multiple layers of it could be county, FBI. So we're looking at multiple layers of systems that come to the table, and then trying to figure out who's in the lead on the case and who's taking charge can be very complicated.
As you mentioned, not all of these cases happen on or involve reservations. But when they do, do tribal police departments have the resources, the person power to pursue these investigations as much as they need to be?
No, we do not. Absolutely not. And it's interesting because our search parties are folks that are trained in this, are really volunteers. And they travel all over the state. So we don't have one for each community. It may be somebody coming from a different area, and there are very small volunteer groups of folks that may have retired from fire departments or police or old ex-police officers that kind of just do this on a very volunteer basis and have very limited resources.
A while back, I talked to former Senator Byron Dorgan and Nikki Petrie, who's an advocate on the national stage for the issue of missing and exploited Indigenous women. This is a nationwide problem. This isn't just Wisconsin. As you're on this task force, are you looking to other states, other parts of the country that have made efforts that have helped, that have moved things in the right direction?
Yeah, so we're really, you know, even before we began to conduct our very first meeting, we really looked for our northern relatives, which was Canada, and worked closely with them to kind of find out what happened when they did their report. The Canadian Inquiry is the biggest report that's been conducted in Indigenous communities. And so we really looked for them to see what were some of the things that they found. Are there things that we could learn from their process? And then we worked with New Mexico and Minnesota recently put out their reports. We worked very closely with them to figure out what they're discovering, and then what are some of the things that we can do here in Wisconsin to collaborate on a nationwide effort.
And I'm thinking we've been talking mostly about what happens after a woman is reported missing. Are there things that we can do to make Indigenous women less vulnerable to kidnapping, exploitation, the other things that might prevent these things happening in the first place?
There's so many things that need to be done. You know, I look at, I work in the field of sexual assault with the Wisconsin Coalition, and I was looking at just general information about beds, like shelter beds, so a women's shelter for domestic violence. There's only 60 Indigenous shelters throughout the entire country. And so I know that Bad River or Red Cliff don't have a women's shelter right on the reservation. And so there's not even a safe place for women to go if they're in a domestic violence, which ultimately leads to homicide. And so there's such a lack of resources that you're really starting to see what results, and the end result is death in our community.
Is this something that the state task force is looking at, not just the response after something bad has happened, but the prevention angle?
Yeah, so absolutely. Wisconsin is going to be really unique in the fact that our end result of this task force will be a report in the state of Wisconsin. But we also are going a step further in trying to create an implementation plan, because this can't be solved in the few years that the task force is convened. This needs to be we have a long way to go. We know that, and we need to put in a plan into place for the future.
I know sometimes reports get filed and not a lot of action is taken. Who needs to take the lead, do you think, to make sure that the recommendations that come out of this, they're actually pursued and not just, for a year or two, but actually get put into the DNA of how police departments operate, local governments and tribal governments operate?
You know, honestly, because legislation for this bill of creating the task force kind of fell flat, so we really do need the public and the people to rally like I said, on this cause in the future, we're not going to see the type of movement that we need. We need the state to take the lead. We need departments, and we have, and that's what we're building right now is relationships. Our task force is a 40-member voting task force, and it has multiple players from different departments and all 12 Indigenous tribes represented. We can't stop that momentum after this report is done. We have both, it's bipartisan, so we have both parties at the table. And we are now creating subcommittees that have 20-plus agencies, system partners that are sitting at the table. And so folks are really coming to the table on the task force. And so we have to keep up that momentum past the task force and into the future. And that's where the real change is going to happen.
What would you say to members of the public to encourage them to pay attention to this, to take it seriously as an issue and maybe seek out these stories, even if they're not plastered across the headlines and cable news coverage?
Yeah, we need to, I think that's really important. What we're starting to see is public awareness is really key to for folks not to be able to put their blinds on when it comes to this issue. We need folks to be to understand that this is happening, and it's happening here in Wisconsin. And we all should be afraid that this type of violence is happening in our communities. And there should be a non-acceptance for anyone to be disposed and not paid attention to when this type of crisis is happening. So I do hope that folks really do look into this issue and put resources behind it and rally. And I hope to see partnerships built through this that really, really attack all of the areas that we need to really make a change for the future of our people.
In just our last less than a minute now, look 10 years ahead. Where do you hope we are in Wisconsin?
I hope in Wisconsin we have funding resources that support this cause. I hope that we have folks that are on the table creating legislative changes that will help address this. I hope that we see a decrease in the amount of folks that we have that are murdered and missing in our communities. And I hope that we have partnerships in place that if it does happen, that we have folks that can help us, including media. Media is very important in this cause.
Justine, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. I appreciate your time.
That's Justine Rufus, co-chair of the Wisconsin Department of Justice Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women Task Force. She's with us today to talk about the work that task force is doing and shining a light on the issue in Wisconsin. Coming up, we'll look at the state of civics education in Wisconsin and a state Republican plan to change the way it's taught. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, 18 months later than planned, Bond is back. It's Daniel Craig's fifth and final outing as 007. Jen White and her panel of pop culture experts will talk about No Time to Die, that and more, today at 6 on 1A+. Now, a bill that would create a civics education mandate in Wisconsin is now in the hands of the state Senate after passing the assembly this week. It would create a statewide civics curriculum for all public and private schools. It would also require all public high school students to take a civics course in order to graduate. The bill was passed on Tuesday by a 61-37 vote. State Superintendent Jill Underley had also called for stricter civics requirements in her State of Education address last week. The move comes after a report by a conservative think tank that gave Wisconsin an F for its statewide standards on teaching civics and American history. The main critique, the state didn't have a statewide course requirement, though most schools have standards in place. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the idea of having stronger civics requirements for Wisconsin students? Will that lead to better functioning government? If you're a teacher, do you incorporate news and politics into your classes? What should we teach? How should we teach about civics? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Brett Barker is a professor of history at UW-Stevens Point and chair of the Department of History and International Studies. Brett, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Rob.
Well, I mentioned that report is from the Fordham Institute. It gave Wisconsin an F because we didn't have these statewide requirements. A lot of school districts said, well, we're already doing this. What do you think of the idea of mandating civics education in our schools?
I think the idea of a civics course is probably a good one. I think that we need people to be versed in the way our government works, to be able to participate as citizens in a democracy. So I think the basic idea is a good one. As you said, I think most school districts already handle that on their own. So I don't want one thing to be interesting to know is how many school districts would this actually impact if this law went into effect that aren't teaching any civics at the moment, because I think that number would be relatively small.
Assembly Speaker Robin Voss spoke on the floor before the vote on this bill and why it's needed. Here's a listen.
What it does say is that we have to have a basic understanding of how change is made. It's not by yelling louder. It's not by somehow ignoring our history. It's by educating people to say, how do you vote? How do you actually go to a city council meeting? How do you run for office? What are the branches of government that, I don't know about you, but I have been correcting an awful lot of people who somehow think that I, as a state legislator, have the power to enforce the law. That's the executive branch. I don't have that power.
Do you think, Brett, that better civics knowledge would lead to more civil government and civil interaction?
Well, I do think it might add to the participation. I think there's a valid point to be made there that what we need also is not only knowledge about how our government works, but I think a recommitment by many people across the spectrum to have a civil discourse about when we disagree. I think that one of the problems is not just civics, but that civility that he mentioned there. I think it's more and more rare that people have a calm, meaningful discussion about genuine disagreements, particularly when it comes to government.
Part of the reason I want to talk to you in particular, Brett, about this as a historian is I can envision a civics class that is very, and because I think I took one, that's very nuts and bolts. Here is how a bill becomes a law. Here's how you vote, that sort of thing, versus something that's kind of civics in action through American history. What are your thoughts on how we learn civics and how much we connect it to change over time in the United States?
Well, I think there's no question, Rob, that if you don't make it real and you don't tell students exactly why it matters and how it's worked in the past. For instance, just to know how change comes about is a good thing to know, but also to understand that change has occurred in the past. I think that one thing I worry about a lot is that sometimes people become so jaded over the idea that they can't make a difference, that they can't interact with government successfully, and that government itself is powerless to make positive change, that they simply throw their hands up in the air. And so they might know how a bill becomes a law, they might know how to attend a city council meeting, but if they don't believe that that is worthwhile, and they don't believe that those actions by ordinary Americans in the past have made a real difference, then it will be just a nuts and bolts thing that they probably will forget about soon after they take the course.
Well, that's interesting. Does it make sense to do an isolated civics class in and of itself? Or, and I know some districts say this is more what they're doing, they work it into their history class or their whatever social studies class at the grade appropriate level. Is this something that's better taught in those contexts? Or do you think there's room for kind of a standalone civics?
Well, I think that's a big question. I would assume that any civics course that was standalone, which the bill proposes, would have to do those things, would have to somehow bring in history or bring in sort of current events. Otherwise, I think it would come across to students as sort of lacking meaning and context. I don't think it's the kind of thing that would engage them in the way that we desperately want students to become engaged in the democratic process.
Talking to Brett Barker, professor of history at UW Stevens Point, chair of the Department of History and International Studies there, looking at civics education in schools and Wisconsin schools in particular, how we teach it, whether there should be a state mandate to have a separate civics class for graduation. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What did you learn about the way our government works in your own education? What worked? What stuck with you? Or was it just kind of dry and you forgot about it the day after graduation? What would you like to see taught in our schools? What questions do you have for our guest? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. If you're a current teacher yourself or former teacher, that's fine too. Or a current student maybe in one of these classes right now. Thanks for listening. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Brett, one big question in teaching American history and civics right now is, do we do the warts and all version? Do we have kind of an idealized version of American history and functioning government? Or do we look at the darker patches in American history, the places where things went wrong? We've talked about that before on the show. What are your thoughts on what we should be talking about?
I think that we have done a better job than we used to do in trying to present American history in its full scope in both good and bad. I think that that is still something that, particularly at the K-12 level, sometimes teachers struggle with because they're under a lot of pressure. And I think that we've seen that in a larger culture, that sometimes people think that an American history course should only present America in a positive light. And I think a lot of folks, and certainly folks like me who teach it at the college level, think that while it's certainly worthwhile to talk about the successes in the American past, that if we don't talk about the shortcomings, if we don't talk about where the United States has not lived up to its ideals, that it will be not really the sort of path to having students ask questions about how we got to where we are and if they themselves can make the nation a better nation within their own lives and their own experiences.
Another bill that's passing in the assembly, kind of in parallel to the civics education one, is related to how issues of race are taught in schools. Generally, the buzzwords around critical race theory are part of this bill. A memo came out with a bunch of phrases that would be seen as problematic, as red flags, kind of. And one of the phrases, there are a lot of kind of academic-y ones. One was racial prejudice as something that might be a flag that a school's curriculum was in violation of this proposed law. That phrase in particular, racial prejudice, how hard would it be to teach American history without talking about that topic?
Well, you know, I don't know how you teach American history without touching that topic. It's strange. I saw the list of words that you're referring to, and it seems as if some of them, I can't imagine. I know that social justice and racial justice were two other of the ones there. If we get to the point where there are words we can't use, then people just adopt different words to talk about the same ideas, I think. So trying to prescribe a list of words seems sort of wrongheaded, and I think really in the long run is just impossible to enforce, and it's just a bad idea. I think that when we're talking about how do we engage students in civics or in history, if we don't make it real, if we don't make it something worth debating, something worth thinking about, something worth critical thinking, and something worth talking about and having hard conversations about, then can we be surprised when they aren't really engaged and the material doesn't really stay with them? I think that the two go hand in hand.
We heard from Don in Sheboygan, who says he'd like to see civics courses teach about what he calls the insidious ways people's votes are gerrymandered. That's obviously an issue of importance right now all over the country as every state redistricts after the census. Do you see opportunities, maybe when you're teaching history, if there's relevant things coming up, to bring these issues into the classroom?
Absolutely. And I think that one of the things that's important when we're teaching these things is to give them a historical perspective. I mean, you know, the very term gerrymandering is a very old term. It was a person named Elbridge Gerry who they created a district that looked like a salamander, and that's where the phrase comes from. And so it has a long tradition, but I also think that talking about the way politics actually works in a civics course, not just the theoretical constructs of how a bill becomes a law, but things like how do people draw districts to their advantage, or how do people decide voting rights and the like, are vital parts of that discussion that have to be included.
We're talking about civics education in Wisconsin with Brett Barker, history professor at UW-Stevens Point, author and chair of the Department of History and International Studies. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Should Wisconsin require students to pass a specific civics course in order to graduate, or do you want to see civics incorporated into other classes, the histories and social studies? If you're a parent, do you talk with your kids about current events and politics and how government works? What did you think of the way you learned or are currently learning about civics in your school. Teachers love to hear from you as well at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about civics education in Wisconsin. A report from the Fordham Institute gave the state an F for statewide standards on teaching civics and American history. State Assembly Republicans passed a bill this week that would require high school students at public schools to take a civics course in order to graduate. A lot of schools say they're already doing this one way or another. Brett Barker is with us, history professor at UW-Stevens Point, chair of the Department of History and International Studies, and you can join in with your thoughts, your experiences, taking or teaching civics. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Let's go to your calls now. Mike is with us in St. Lawrence. Mike, hi.
Hey, hi. Yeah, I don't know about going into all the critical race theory and all that stuff, but I think if you started out in, I don't know what grade, third, fourth, fifth grade or something like, and started with your local area and just started teaching the basics, whether you're in a borough or whether you're in a district in Wisconsin, or whether you're in a different, in Louisiana, but and just work your way out from your local and all the way through the state, and then state by state, and how the different governments function. Work your way all the way up. So when a child gets out of 12th grade, they have a basic understanding of how the country actually works, how things function, and you can get into the whether it's in social studies or in civics or in history. But I think that would really help this country out, that people really knew how the government functioned. Because you listen to people and you ask them questions and they, well, I don't know. I don't know. What's gerrymandering? I have no idea what gerrymandering is.
Mike, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. What do you think? Bottom-up approach. Start with the local government, Brett, and work your way up to the national.
I think that's a great idea. That's the way a lot of school districts, I believe the Wausau School District, does that they start at the third grade level talking about the community and sort of thinking about history and civics in a very local context, then moving out to the state, then the national, then global. And I think that makes a lot of sense with children in development. And I think you're right. If they need to understand, I think sometimes a lot of emphasis is put on how the federal government works. And of course, that's important. But as the caller said, it's also important in how your town and county government works as well.
Thanks for that call. We'll go to Ezra now in Bessemer, Michigan. Ezra, hi.
Yeah, it's Daniel, and this is my 38th year. I like what the professor said about you have to teach all the warts and everything. There's a certain beauty and tragedy in American history, but it's all good stuff. I talk to some of my students. I teach in Ashland. I talk about talked to my students today about the 1920 lynchings in Duluth, and they had never heard of that, but that's a good issue to explore without politicizing anything. It's a good issue to show how race relations were in 1920. And with government gerrymandering, kids need to understand how congressional districts work. And when I taught at the college, they were fascinated with how the numbers worked in an election and how the votes counted. So I think it's a great thing to talk about and introduce civics education at 9th and 12th grade or earlier. Thank you.
Thanks for calling. Sorry, we got your name wrong. I think we got a wire cross there, but point well taken. What do you think about his strategy in teaching, Brett?
Well, absolutely. I think that if students are not exposed to the good and the bad, and sometimes, frankly, they find fascinating the less perfect parts of our past, they also find fascinating, as Daniel just said. And so I think exposing all of that is really important so that they don't get a skewed version of a sort of a nation that they can't possibly live up to. Our greatest leaders had flaws, but they were still, did great things. And I think you have to understand, to me, a person worth admiring is even more admirable when we understand they were a human being like we were, who had both good points and were flawed, that no one can possibly live up to some sort of a perfect notion, and no nation can live up to always being perfect. And understanding that, I think, is an important part of being a responsible citizen.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Looking at civics education, how it's taught, how it should be taught, if it should be a standalone class or worked in elsewhere. And you can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, maybe your memories or your current experiences learning or teaching about the way American government works. Back to your calls now. Sandy is with us in Lake Geneva. Sandy, hi.
Hi. Okay, I want to start off by saying I really love this idea. I think it's fantastic. It's great. It should be done. But my question is, what do we take out of the curriculum to put this in?
Thanks a lot for that question. And when I was a producer here a long time ago, Brett, I could have booked entire shows with schools should be teaching blank. And, you know, yes. The question coming up, how are schools going to teach all those blanks? Is there room for civics education?
Well, and I think that's your point is well taken, how perhaps it is best sort of woven into other subjects like history and social studies, as you said, because that is one of the things that I know teachers face on a daily basis is they're asked to cover more and more material and to do it well. And that's right. That's one problem with mandates like this that I think we have to be careful to make sure that we spend adequate time on the things we decide are really important. But yes, I think there's no question that civics has a place. And that's why I think it's already being taught in the vast majority of our schools. And I think what we need to think about is the most effective ways to use time to teach them effectively in a way that will grasp students' attention and really get them interested in the topic.
Thanks a lot for that call. We'll go to Jessica now in Milwaukee. Jessica, hi.
Hi. Pardon me. I'm actually not from Wisconsin. I moved here from Illinois several years ago, and I vividly remember as a high school freshman, we had to take a constitution test. It was required as part of our high school freshman history class. And so in order to pass it, you had to name like three Supreme Court justices and answer how many senators and congressmen it takes to pass a bill. It was just one part of freshman history class, but like I said, I still remember some of the bits and pieces, and I think it's at least a start, you know, for kids and students and should be expanded upon. And I didn't realize that it wasn't required everywhere, but I guess it's not.
Jessica, thanks a lot for that call. Well, obviously some of it stuck with her, Brett.
Yes. I think that's the odd thing, too, is we don't know exactly what will stick, but I think it's important to give students that exposure so that they do take something with them. And hopefully, again, if you can hook them into the idea that this is something important that they know to be a part of a democracy, that hopefully I think all the teachers do in the end is plant seeds and hope that those seeds sprout and grow as students learn on their own through the rest of their lives.
Thanks for that call. Time for one more caller. Jamie is with us in Spooner. Jamie, hi.
Hi. I'm from... grew up in Janesville, Wisconsin, went to Craig High School. We had and it was not mandatory, and it should have been mandatory, class taught by Frank Douglass. First one was world geography, and that's where you just learned the different countries, how they worked, and, you know, everything from the culture to the politics, and he would make the room into Japanese this week and, you know, an African country next week. A great, great teacher. The second course was international studies. And that's where we got into the politics and how different countries operated differently and how the politics worked and how, you know, it was just a wonderful class.
Jamie, we don't have too much time left. Thank you for that tribute to the teacher and the teaching. And Brett, this is a case where this Janesville Craig teacher said, I'm not going to make this dry as dust. We can make this fun and engaging and informative, right?
We keep coming back to that. Whatever the standards are, it's the teachers that we really rely on to make it come to life. And that's the key to whatever standards they are. They have to be put into practice in the classroom. And I think overall teachers do a great job at that.
Jamie, thanks a lot for the call. Brett, leave us with some inspiration, whether we're in school or not, to get to know more about our local through federal government.
Well, I think that the only thing that almost everybody across the political spectrum could probably agree on today is that it's probably more important than ever to truly understand how the government works, how democracy works, and how to participate and to believe that if you dare to participate, you can bring about a change. It may be a small change. It may be at the local level, but whatever level it is, that being part of that is being part of a long experiment that reaches back for centuries in our country. And I think it's important that the next generation continue to be inspired to be a part of that ongoing conversation and journey.
Brett, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
Brett Barker is a history professor at UW-Stevens Point, chair of the Department of History and International Studies. We talked to him about civics education in Wisconsin as a bill in the state legislature looks to have a mandate for a civics education class requirement for graduation. If anybody's looking to teach and learn about redistricting Wisconsin, I humbly point you toward the work of my colleagues. The Mapped Out podcast just dropped the first edition yesterday. You can find it at WPR.org. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 8, find out how family courts in Wisconsin deal with cases of domestic abuse. That's tomorrow at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll look at the additional stress being placed on veterinarians and animal hospitals during the pandemic and how pet owners can help them out. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.